Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. But first, Jim, an update from yesterday's Three Martini Lunch. You asked the question, why do we have bills in the denomination of one, two, really, is also still in there, but five, 10, 20, 50, 100, whereas coins, it's 1, 5, 10, 25, 50, 100. Well, one of our listeners emailed in and said, for most of American history, an ounce of gold was worth $20, and the Treasury was legally obligated to redeem $20 bills known as gold certificates in those days for gold. Pay to the bearer on demand, they said, as opposed to what the listener calls the insipid, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. As for coinage, metallic money historically was fractionated, i.e. halves, quarters, eighths. In this regime, the dime was actually the oddball. Before the government eliminated silver from all circulating American currency in 1964, dimes, quarters, 50-cent pieces, and dollar coins contained a legally specified weight of silver, which is why the dime is smaller than the nickel, because the nickel was always minted with less valuable metal. So we like to inform. Today we've been informed.
You know, that's pretty striking, Greg. There's one other aspect that came to me after we finished our discussion yesterday. And I remember people arguing about this every time there's been an effort to get a dollar coin into circulation and things like that. Do you know why there's a great resistance to adding new denominations, either coin or money?
Why is that?
Or other coins or bills? Cash registers.
Ah.
They're set to take a certain amount. All of a sudden, you have both a $20 bill and a $25 bill. You need another place to put your 20s and you're separate from your 25s. Otherwise, you get them mixed up and people get the wrong change and things like that. So that's probably why it will never happen, because of the big cash register lobby in Washington.
You ever try to stuff a Susan B. Anthony dollar in a vending machine? It's not a pretty experience.
It is, and that's one of those things. Everything is built for a certain way, and then you come up with an idea, we got to change it. Hell with it.
So. On to the good martini now. Democrats in disarray. This has been our most consistent good martini. This is from the Hill newspaper. Anxiety is rising among Democrats ahead of Tuesday's primary in New York, with some fearing the battle between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders has reached the danger zone. Cue the Kenny Loggins music there. Sanders has leveled some of his most biting criticism at Clinton in recent days, stirring passions in the race that insiders say could leave the party divided into the November elections. The Vermont senator has long drawn contrast between himself and Clinton, but his attacks have grown more caustic of late, particularly with regard to the former First Lady's links to big financial companies. He was equally scathing during last week's debate, when Clinton insisted that during her time as a New York senator, she had called out banks for poor mortgage practices. And we played that bite last week. There's a quote from the odious Chris Lehane, Democratic strategist, who folks might remember from the Gore campaign way back when. He says, while this is the NFL and everyone understands that it's a full contact sport, even in the NFL, one gets a yellow flag for a late hit at the knees intended to hurt the other player. So Bernie Sanders is apparently the James Harrison or the Vontaze Burfict of the Democratic primary system here.
And if anybody knows dirty campaigning, hitting below the knees, it's Chris Lehane.
Yes, it is.
This is the guy who's greeted Schwarzenegger to the 2003 California gubernatorial recall election with, well, he's going to be facing real bullets now. Well, I hope not. That's an attempted assassination. Two observations kind of to add to this. So on one page of the Wall Street Journal today, page A4, Gerald Sieb, their columnist, says, you know, this is the argument about the damage Sanders-Clinton bashing may do, that basically, ultimately, in the general election, if Hillary Clinton wins the nomination, she's going to need all these Bernie Sanders voters to come out and vote for her. Now, we as cynical Republicans, Greg, have seen this lots of times. Yes, every once in a while, people will peel off and support a Ralph Nader type, but generally, Democrats all fall in line. However, on the exact opposite page, on their story about their most recent poll of Democrats nationally, and yes, there are some people who would argue that there's dubious value to a national poll after everybody's already, you know, a good chunk of the states have already cast their ballots. But the most recent Wall Street Journal poll has Clinton at 50% of Democrats and Bernie Sanders at 48%. Technically speaking, this is a pretty much a tied primary right now, even though she's probably going to do well tonight and she's still way ahead once you throw in the superdelegates. The quote that jumped out at me, Greg, is this line from Peter Hart, Democratic pollster, who helped conduct the Wall Street Journal survey. America is on the path to electing the most unpopular president since 1948. And that applies to Hillary. That would apply to Trump as well. And it just kind of seems really striking. Like, even Democrats don't like her that much. And you really, you know, like that, maybe you should worry about turnout in a circumstance like that. There could be a sense of a lot of Democrats having seen, you know, their somebody who they thought was super duper terrific in the White House for the past 8 years and being kind of disappointed with the results. Maybe they're just not going to be all that enthused this year. Now, obviously, if you're a Republican, you can't count on that. But you have to be, you know, there's a reason that they're hitting the panic button. And, you know, they should be playing Kenny Loggins over there. And not, you know, it's not the cool fun danger zone you want to get into. It's the oh, our base may not turn out for us this year danger zone.
It's also, as you mentioned, Jim, primary day in New York today. Do you think the Trump kids are voting for Hillary or Bernie?
Well, we know at least two of them won't be voting for anybody because they weren't registered as Republicans.
I believe one of them, at least one of them, was registered as a Democrat.
Oh, really? Because I know that one of them was registered independent with no party. So.
Oh, yeah, then they're sitting it out. So that's a fun cry of disenfranchisement that we're hearing from some sectors today, is that independents aren't allowed to vote in Republican and Democratic primaries. So that's it's rigged again.
You know who really likes the fact that, that independents can't vote in a Republican primary, Greg? Republicans!
Yes! It's the way it used to be.
If you want to say and who my party nominates, then join the Pershtunkin party. You know, it's not that hard. And you got to think of it the day before, more than just the day before the primary. Oh, wait a minute. I wanted to vote in that one, you know.
Oh, yes. All right. On to the bad martini now. And as Jim pointed out in the Morning Jolt on Monday, and it got a lot of traction, Bernie Sanders released his 2014 tax returns over the past weekend, revealing that he and his wife made just north of $200,000. They took $60,208 in deductions and essentially paid an effective federal tax rate of 13.5%. So, as you point out in today's Jolt, Jim, that is very much contrary to the deductions that Bernie Sanders would love to just wipe off the boards. And it looks like he would also try to trim back the mortgage deduction, but in a way that wouldn't affect him, which is awfully convenient. And as we've basically learned over the last 24 hours, liberal hypocrisy doesn't bother liberals in the least.
Yeah, we actually didn't learn that in the last 24 hours. We learned that in the last 24 years or so. But it's worth noting, one, this is, you know, a couple people have said, oh, I bet you he didn't donate anything to any money to charity. Well, according to his tax returns, he donated $8,000 in terms of financial stuff, and then another donation that was $300-some. I'll let listeners decide whether they think that is sufficiently big-hearted of Bernie Sanders. But what jumps out at me are the deductions, because, as you know, he's paying less than the average tax rate of the average American. And this is kind of exactly what he argues about when he goes out on the stump, that all these wealthy people aren't paying their fair share and they pay a lower effective tax rate. Notice that modifier there, because most millionaires are paying something in the neighborhood of like a 26, 27, 28% taxes of their total income. That's a lot. That's a lot more than Bernie Sanders is. But what they argue is, well, the effective tax rate is less because they take deductions, and your average secretary or somebody who's working class wouldn't take the deductions because they don't have – they're better off if they take the standard deduction than if they itemize. For anybody not familiar, you've just did your taxes, you're probably familiar with this, but just in case, standard deduction is, I'm not going to bother with it. I'm going to assume I get $12,500. If you have more, you have things that the government has decided will be exempted from your taxable income. You're going to list them out specifically. Bernie Sanders laid it all out. He was in the neighborhood of $23,000 in interest on his mortgage payments. Hey, that's a lot. Who's Bernie Sanders' realtor? You add up the value of the two of his homes. We don't know exactly how much debt he has left, but it's probably going to be more than $300,000. And under the Bernie Sanders tax plan, you're only allowed to deduct the interest you pay on your mortgages below $300,000, meaning they kind of put a cap on it. Right now, there is a cap. It's $500,000 if you're a single, $1 million if you're a couple. Then the second one is that Bernie Sanders is still worried about rich people taking all these deductions. No word on whether he thinks making $205,000 a year is rich. That's how much he's making. It looks pretty good to a lot of people, but I'm sure he thinks of it as well. It's not, you know, he's not super rich. He's not, you know, Bill Gates or Donald Trump money. All right, fine. But he believes that you should be capped on how much of the deductions you can take. And if you make more than $250,000 a year, notice that to Bernie Sanders, being rich is about $50,000 more than what he's making. That's when you really become rich.
Right.
then you cannot deduct more than 28% of your total income for the year. Oh, by the way, if you add up all of Bernie Sanders' deductions, he's deducting 29.3% of his total income for the year. So there's two cases in which if the Bernie Sanders tax plan was in place, he would not be allowed to take the deductions that he does. Now, does this mean I'm saying he's committing tax fraud? No. I am saying that what he wants to eliminate things that there are things he sees in the tax code that he thinks are bad. He thinks that rich people take advantage of them. He thinks this is fundamentally unfair, that this is something that should not be, and he wants to eliminate them. Every once in a while, he'll use the term loophole. And as my colleague Charlie Cook likes to point out, when something is written specifically into the law on purpose by Congress, it's not a loophole. It's not a mistake. Congress didn't forget to tax your mortgage interest. They specifically wanted that to be tax-free because they want to make it easier for you to own your home. So Bernie Sanders wants to get rid of this stuff, but as long as it's in there, he's going to take advantage of that. And I look at that and I say, you know, that's kind of hypocritical of that, because he's the guy who's saying we need to do more. In fact, Greg, he specifically says we should be taxed based on our ability to pay. Well, Bernie Sanders can afford to pay a lot more in taxes, can he?
Absolutely.
Well, there you go. So again, it's always what it really means is I want other people to pay more taxes is kind of the rallying cry of Bernie Sanders. And my suspicion is quite a few of his supporters feel the same way.
All right. On to the crazy martini now. And as we've mentioned a couple times, today is primary day in New York. It's the only state on the calendar today. And on Morning Joe today, they had New York Congressman Peter King on, who represents a district in Long Island. And they made the joke heading into the segment that the new Republican county chairman in Nassau County was endorsing Ted Cruz, which is true. But then they tried to pretend that it was Peter King was the new chairman. And Peter King has longstanding distaste for Ted Cruz. And here's how that initial introduction to the segment went.
Our good friend Peter King.
Loves him.
Incredible. Yeah, Republican Congressman Peter King of New York.
He loves him.
Congressman, congratulations on your new chairman position. Here's actually a quote from Congressman King about Ted Cruz. Any New Yorker who even thinks of voting for Ted Cruz should have their head examined.
Okay, well, this is a little turnabout.
So wait a minute. What happens tonight on the Republican side? How big does Donald Trump win,
by the way? Well, first of all, in case anybody gets confused, I am not endorsing Ted Cruz. I hate Ted Cruz. And I think I'll take cyanide if he ever got the nomination.
I'm not endorsing Ted Cruz. I hate Ted Cruz. We'll take cyanide if he gets the nomination. Obviously, we think he's kidding with that, but he's quite the bomb thrower, Jim.
Ah, very good. See, because there are a couple of thoughts there. First of all, considering the controversy that Peter King has gotten in throughout the portion of his career, you will not find a Republican who is a bigger fan of government surveillance, far-reaching and just about everywhere. I think most infamously, he lumped Rand Paul in with ISIS in describing the people who opposed a particular government surveillance bill. Now, whatever you think of Rand Paul, I think it's safe to say he's not on the same moral plane as ISIS. A lot of people don't realize he wants Merrick Garland to get a hearing, and he's saying that GOP senators are being disrespectful for that. But he's also really been vehemently, vehemently anti-Ted Cruz. Called him a big guy with a big mouth and no results. He says he's a carnival barker, go under a rock. And you know, fine, okay, he doesn't like Ted Cruz. The thing about Peter King that sticks out the most for those of us with long memories is that Peter King has been a Republican congressman from the New York City area for a really long time, going back to the 1980s. And Peter King has always, always, always been a big fan of the Irish Republican Army. Now, if you get all of your information from Hollywood movies, you might think of them as being the kind of cute, charming terrorists who are always singing sad songs and, you know, they listening to U2, and they're kind of this, you know, the lovable leprechaun type terrorists. No, the IRA are terrible, terrible people, believe in blowing up public buildings, blowing up shopping malls, killing innocent people. They're the most wildly romanticized terror group you've ever seen. And I say this as an Irish American who's, you know, on the Catholic side and theoretically should be supporting these guys, but they blow up innocent people. And at some point, whatever claim they had to be a movement of national liberation, they lost any of that moral authority. And oh, by the way, they seem to act more and more like a gang. There's probably a car bomb outside my house as I say this, Greg. But anyway, so here's Peter King, who's always said this, and the guy who, oh, by the way, is also the guy who most believes in monitoring mosques and tracking down Americans and talking about the dire threat of terrorism within our shores, when Peter King was always there when the Irish Republican Army needed fundraising back in the 1980s. And a lot of people find this. So when Peter King says, you know, I'll take cyanide if he gets the nomination, there are a decent number of IRA victims who say, okay, go Cruz. I myself probably, you know, I don't want to see Peter King kill himself. But the idea of him being in a state of great anguish over Ted Cruz winning the nomination doesn't get my Irish up, Greg.
Do you think he cried at the end of Patriot games?
Why couldn't he get away? Sean Bean was the hero. If only he'd known that Sean Bean always dies.
That's right.
Every role, every film, all the time. Yeah, I was going to go with that. At some point, as we have been known to deviate on this program, Greg, we need to do one on how Hollywood treats the IRA, because we could do that one. We could do the Harrison Ford, Brad Pitt movie.
Yes.
Which really struggled with the idea of, when you cast Brad Pitt, you're not casting him to be the bad guy, right? You're casting him to be the soulful, sympathetic bad guy, where it's tragic that he has to be caught. Or I think my all-time favorite comes from the remake of The Day of the Jackal, called The Jackal, featuring Bruce Willis as the bad guy. And Richard Gere as a, quote, IRA sharpshooter, unquote. Traditionally, it's called a sniper. And traditionally, it's used to shoot people. But, you know, he was like almost like this master trick shot guy or something. You know, I don't know about you. When I think of roughneck terrorists, Greg, I think of Richard Gere. When I think of Ireland, I think of Richard Gere. Probably his most implausible casting since his love scene with Jodie Foster in that Western. I'll just leave it right there. I've gotten myself in enough trouble today, as is, Greg.
Perfect way to end it. Jim, talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and tune in again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.